The beginning of spring always feels like a revitalization. It's a chance for fresh perspectives, long walks in the sunshine, taking in the riot of blossom, the dangling catkins and the plucky green shoots. This show marks the moment with an homage to the season. We'll find out about the art of traversing the streets of Rome with author Cynthia Zarin, and we'll pop some corks and awaken the senses with sommelier Honey Spencer. As Confect's Spring magazine hits the newsstands, this edition of the show gives listeners a sneak peek of what can be found in its pages. We'll hear an interview with musician Marika Hackman, and we'll discover Julia Lessica's ode to the tradition of Paisanki and decorating eggs. This is Confect Corner, and I'm your host, Sophie Grove.
You just have to show up for it, like every day, like any other job, really. Like, I'm not going to write a song if I'm not sitting with an instrument somewhere quiet. Like, I can't walk around town and be like, ah, I'm not Paul McCartney dreaming up yesterday, whatever it is, you know? So it's like, I have to be there for it.
Natural wine, no drama, is a kind of nod to kind of get over it. Natural wine is here to stay. It's how wine was always made, more or less, you know, until like the last century. And there's so much to be discovered.
As tanks rolled through the forests of Ukraine's northern border and streams of camouflaged soldiers entered the southern and eastern cities, Lent began. In a show of resilience and determination to stick to their traditions, women across the country unwrapped their kistki and began to mix their dyes.
Welcome to Confect Corner. I'm your host, Sophie Grove, in London. And for this month's episode, I'm joined from Zurich by our style director, Marcella Palick, and here in the studio in London by our markets editor for luxury, Brenda Tui.
Lovely to be here.
Welcome, Brenda.
Thank you.
Welcome to Confect Corner and to the Confect family. We thought this would be a great way to introduce you to our listeners. You've been with Monocle and Confect for a few years, but this is a very new role. And just give us a little insight in what you're going to be focusing on.
I am going to focus on jewellery and watches for Confect. It's such a lovely, big format, a beautiful arena in which to place more jewellery and watches.
And, you know, you have a history working at Christie's and, you know, it's very interesting to have that historical dimension, to have that eye for detail, that eye for heritage.
I do have an eye for heritage and in particular I'm very interested in jewellery and have been working in jewellery for many years. There are all the big brands. There are new and interesting jewellery designers. There's vintage jewellery. There are many different avenues you can wander down, quite sparkly ones, and gleaming streets of jewellery. So that is what I'm going to focus on.
Well, it's very interesting because it's something we started to focus more on at Confect. You know, this idea of storytelling through jewellery, this idea of gemology, of provenance, of craft. There's so many dimensions to the arena of jewellery. And it's fascinating to have a real industry insight, but also just it's very creative space. Well, let's continue with our regular show and tell. As listeners will know, we always like to start the show like this. And Marcella, what do you have for us today?
So when I visited Bucharest to meet the amazing fashion designer Irina Morozanu, we headed to the impressive, huge National Museum of the Romanian Peasant she wanted absolutely to show me. Unfortunately, the museum was just closing when we arrived there. But there was an amazing, huge shop, not just a little gift shop, but a huge shop with all kinds of crafted objects. So we stayed quite a while there. I found hand-painted empty Easter eggs with colorful ribbons for the decoration of blossom branches, wild masks hand-sewn from fabric scraps, great vintage leather accessories like belts and bags, ceramics with rustic ornaments, embroidered table linens, and so on and so on. It was so interesting, and I felt like it was a museum of real Romanian life.
Your story for the spring issue, which is about to come out, is so phenomenal. Bucharest, the Paris of the East, and it's really beautifully written. But this idea of the craft and, you know, some of the folkloric sort of elements coming into the modern wardrobe is quite interesting, and you touch on it in your piece.
So, and how about you, Sophie?
Well, I've just come back from Lisbon, which was a lovely trip south of London, really. The light there was amazing. But I really have a sense that Lisbon is having such an interesting moment, because we had a little party, as we tend to do when we're on the road, with Confect. And a few people who came were just from all walks of life. There's a Ukrainian couple who'd set up a concept store called Conceptica. These incredibly chic people who'd really decamped because of the war, but were there thriving. So many incredible entrepreneurial, creative people in one city with no particular anchor to Portugal. And it struck me that that city is so alive at this moment, and it has that feeling of kind of Casablanca in the war. You know, this kind of wonderful meeting of minds and sense of possibility, which really excited me.
Lots of opportunity there.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a kind of can-do attitude, which occasionally lacks in really big metropolis where everyone feels everything's been done.
Yes, and I suppose maybe less likely to have to follow the processes, maybe, or the bureaucracy that might exist in other bigger cities.
Well, possibly. And then I think we stayed in, I suppose, on the kind of Champs-Élysées equivalent in Lisbon. There's amazing shop there, Fashion Clinic, which is multi-brand. And there's this great little place we went to, Je ne sais quoi, which is kind of like a members club. But it felt the very pronounced Lisboeta style, you know, in terms of fashion, but in terms of that wonderful gregarious colour and sense of confidence was really there. And I found that inspiring. It's always like that when you travel from Northern Europe, where frankly we are, at this time of year, you kind of jump the seasons and then you feel that sense of excitement in just being somewhere else that's even a few degrees warmer. It's not just the weather, it was also just the spirit of the city, which was really inspiring. Brenda, tell me what you've been up to.
Well, I took myself off to Tate Britain to see the Sargent and Fashion exhibition. And although Sargent, I suppose, was essentially a portrait painter, he was very daring with his sitters and the way he portrayed them and the way he painted sumptuous fabrics and his great attention to detail. I mean, there's the famous portrait of Madame X, which was hanging there, which caused such a sensation at the time of its unveiling. Sargent had originally painted the sitter with one of her little spaghetti straps kind of down on her arm, not on her shoulder, and he had to repaint it back up on her shoulder because society was shocked by that kind of behavior by a young woman in the late 1800s. He also had a way of painting a sitter as a kind of a confident, alluring individual, which I think was unusual. So there was the beauty in the fabrics, the velvets, the silks, the way that they were portrayed. And then there was this incredible engagement with the sitter as though she was actually looking straight at you. And in addition to the paintings, they also displayed many of the actual garments that were worn by the sitters in wonderful glass cases. It was incredible to see how tiny everyone was.
I found that, yeah, the waist of these women is very, very worryingly small, but just the fabric, the sumptuousness and the textures. It's very interesting that the Tate Britain have done this exhibition, because it's rare that you see fashion being taken so seriously in this old world art context. And I wonder if that says anything about the way we're kind of reevaluating these portraits.
I suppose we are reevaluating them, really, because I guess in their own time, they were quite daring for portraits. You know, he stepped a little bit out of the norm. You know, the black stenciling around Madame X, you know, is very definite and in great contrast, her black dress and her alabaster skin. And also the expanse of skin in a lot of the paintings, I think, was quite daring.
I think there are big parallels between modern photography and that gaze. I mean, Madame X is a famously profile with this amazing nose. That sense of really being confronted by the sitter is very similar to some fashion photography.
And the scale also. You know, the scale, you could think of Lucian Freud's huge nudes. These paintings are big. They're life size. They're ginormous. So that's quite powerful also.
We start this month on a journey through the streets of Italy. The poet and New Yorker writer Cynthia Zarin's book, In Italy, lyrically documents her ventures through the country she loves, taking readers from Venice to Rome and beyond. Confect's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs caught up with Cynthia a bit earlier.
In the first place, it was the wrong time. It was June. And starting in April, Venice is jammed. Petrarch, in his letters, described the Piazza San Marco as so crowded that if you dropped a grain of millet there, it would never reach the pavement. The first time I went to Venice was in July, a disaster, nothing more than a glimpse of the city called La Serenissima. But the next time it was December. Then I was just married. We stayed at the Hotel La Fenice and heard singers practicing at the opera house through the window, which let in a tongue of cold. In the second place, I did not want to go at all. My life had come to seem like a series of extravagances punctuated by episodes of extreme austerity. Over the past months, I had given my heart away to someone who immediately lost it, taken it back from someone who loved me, and set it off like a top in another direction and watched it teeter crazily. These things happened almost at once. The result was that I was going to Venice alone. I think I had known I would all along. The ostensible reason was to write a story for a magazine. The magazine ran a column in which writers wrote about a city they knew. This suited me, as I rarely go to new places, but instead retraced my steps, looking for breadcrumbs I left long ago that were since eaten by birds. Venice was not on the list of cities and towns that others had chosen. Istanbul, Port-au-Prince, Reykjavik, Santa Monica. I could say anything I liked in 1 to 2,000 words.
Cynthia, thanks so much for speaking with me today about In Italy. It's a really lovely little book, and I wanted to start off by asking you to tell me a little bit about your very first visit to Italy. What can you remember of it?
Oh, my very first visit. I went when I was about 19 with my boyfriend, who had been studying Italian at Perugia for a number of months, and he was a bit older, so I was still at university, and I went to join him for the summer, and I believe that was the first time I'd been to Italy. And I arrived in Umbria at his, where he was living, and then we traveled after that, after he finished his course.
You obviously, it's, you know, it's so clear through this, through these essays, that they're a real kind of love letter to the country. What is it about Italy that fascinated you then, and I assume continues to fascinate you now?
You know, I think there are just places, I'm sure you've experienced it, or your listeners have experienced it, where you just feel at home. There's something in the way the light hits, even the sign at the train station, where you get off and you feel, oh, this place was waiting for me. And of course, I'm not alone in my love for Italy. So many people love Italy. It welcomes people. And I think it was Elizabeth Bowen who said, everyone who comes to Italy is part of the history of Italy. It's not in any way a place where the traveler feels unwelcome.
You mentioned that Elizabeth Bowen, and I wanted to ask you, the essays are kind of full of literary references and these kind of literary figures who've written about Italy, and I wondered who are the kind of figureheads that you turn to, that you really like how they talk about Italy, and how has that influenced your own work?
Well, I think that because my Italian is imperfect, I have really read English writers and American writers on Italy. So Mary McCarthy, writing about Venice and about Florence. Certainly Elizabeth Bowen, a wonderful book called A Time in Rome, which I kind of scavenged for my long essay on Rome and tried to go to see the places that she had found. Certainly Mary Beard on Rome, and then novels about Venice and Rome that are set there, things that I've gone back to continually, because I think everybody's Rome and Venice are the products of their own imagination.
And in your own writing, you've got this quite kind of particular sort of narrative form, and the essays are very winding, and you really feel like you're being taken along the streets of Rome, for example. Could you tell me a little bit more about finding that format and the process of writing these essays, how long it took and what that was like as a journey?
The essay on Venice, I wrote in the course of a week when I had gone to Venice, as the book explains, ultimately because I had been invited to a party. And I thought, you know, how lovely, I shouldn't say no to a party in Venice. And it turned out I was right. So I went for a week, and every night that night, I'm not sure why, I just started, because I don't really keep a journal otherwise, I began to write down my impressions of what I had seen and felt during the course of the day. And that became, over time, with a great deal of editing, the piece about Venice called Serene. That piece was then read by the first publisher of this book, David Zwirner, the gallery, which has a book series. And I was looking at those books, and they asked me if I had anything. And I had this essay, which was too long for a magazine and too short for a book. And they said, well, we love this, and we know you love Rome, so why don't you go to Rome and write an essay on Rome, and then we'll do a little book, which is what happened. The Rome one took a great deal more time because I think because I thought about it more. You know, I had to think about how to enter it, and I hadn't thought about that when I was making these notes about Venice. So trying to position it, and also, of course, to have it have some relationship to the Venice piece, because I knew that they were going to appear together.
You're talking about Venice and Rome mostly, but other places do kind of make small appearances. I wonder if you could talk a little bit, because I felt when I was reading it that there's such personalities to the places, and you're really good at picking out these really interesting details that kind of make you feel like you are there and that they're characters as much as settings. Could you talk a little bit about how you view Italian cities and what kind of personalities you think they bring?
Well, I think if you look, you may be referring in part, there's a shorter piece. There are a couple of shorter pieces, one about Assisi in Italy, and it's about a visit to the Basilica, where I went every day during a long and complicated stay with a friend in Assisi, and I would go every day to the Basilica and explore it. And I'd been there many times before in different years, but this was the first time I'd gone every day, so that I would notice, you know, a little boy walking, learning how to walk, trying to fly like an angel, or in the Roman markets, just looking very closely at what's being sold, and how the most beautiful little berries are always deep inside the market, almost like secrets. So trying to sort of read the map of the place and see what that map is telling me. It's like a treasure hunt.
The world of natural wine is still daunting for many, but one London sommelier and restaurateur is on a mission to change that. Honey Spencer has worked at some of the best restaurants and bars and has now set out to help everyone understand and enjoy all that each unique glass has to offer. To achieve that, she's written a new book, Natural Wine, No Drama, an unpretentious guide, and opened her very own neighbourhood restaurant, Sune, alongside her partner, Charlie Sims, on London's Broadway Market. I wanted to understand more about the fascinating world of natural wine, so earlier I stopped by her restaurant to hear all about it and perhaps sample a glass or two.
I got into wine as a graduate. I just finished a business degree in French, and I was working in restaurants because I love serving people, and it's always been in my kind of family nature to be working in hospitality and very kind of hospitable. I then sort of fell in love with the world of wine because I understood, I suddenly was meeting these sommeliers in the restaurant that I worked, and I was like, how is it possible to travel for a living and have this really beautiful convivial career where you can travel and meet people all the time, serve these beautiful wines in a restaurant, and also straddle a sort of sense of academia as well? You know, there's always something to learn in the world of wine. No one knows everything. I actually find quite freeing.
I mean, I think that's why wine can be daunting for people. Mm. It is that sense of the kind of
artistry of it, but also the science, the intuition. I think there are so many strands that people can have the sense of imposter syndrome. And I wanted to ask you, you're just about to publish a new book, which is about natural wine. There is a real sense that you have been somewhat of a campaigner in trying to make wine more accessible in your writing, in your work. Why do you think that's important?
I think it's an interesting time at the moment to consume any sort of product. But I remember when I first took on opening a wine bar just around the corner from here, actually, called Sagram Wild in Hackney. It was 10 years ago. And I remember that at the time, everyone was drinking like craft cocktails and drinking craft beer and really kind of getting au fait with those worlds. Then Sagram Wild opened, and it was really the first place that had started to kind of draw back on the, I guess, supposed pretense of the wine world. And I found that really, really powerful. And it was really important for us to kind of like help people and embolden consumers to come in and to try different wines. I think particularly now, if people are drinking less and less, you know, you want people to feel like wine can also be theirs and it's not a world that they should be born into. What I've particularly enjoyed about the resurgence of the natural kind of wine world and the interest in natural wine is that people feel like it can be theirs. You know, there's less jargon, less pretense in general, and it's almost like kind of level playing field, so everyone can know something about natural wine.
And what's your advice to our listeners who have that moment, you step into a wine merchant's or you pick up the card in a restaurant and you start having that sense of panic and going for the second
second one down, or whatever it is.
I think people need to hold their nerve firstly, and then what?
It's very much a human thing, and I think we need to really feel like we can talk and be honest with sommeliers and people that work in wine shops. That is the crucial part of advice, knowing how much you want to spend. Because if I'm working in a wine shop or I'm trying to serve you a bottle of wine, you know, and I have no idea if you want to spend £30 or £50 or £70 or even more, it's really nice, really, really helpful to be able to kind of be told, you know, I have this much to spend. Sommeliers will always try and find you the best quality for your budget that you have. But also just kind of not being worried about using the correct language. I think we're all quite good at now going into a cocktail bar and asking for the kind of cocktail that we want. And I think it's just the same mentality that needs to be applied to wine. So it's like, I've got this much to spend. I want something either that tastes like quite classic, or I want something that's a little bit experimental. And as many kind of flavour adjectives or even feelings. I think one of the cool things with natural wine is you can say like, I want to feel like this. You know, I want something that's like salty and invigorating, or something that kind of just makes me feel really mellow. So you can say that, and it's almost like a vibe check that you can do with natural wine.
I love it. Let's talk about the book. A lot of research and a lot of travel. But I'm very struck by the title, which is Natural Wine, No Drama. Why do you think there is a drama around natural wine that needs to be explained?
I was thinking about titles for the book, and I wanted it to be something that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek and a little bit cheeky, because you're right, there is this idea that natural wine is kind of, I don't know, it's not real wine, or it should be put in a completely different category, and there's a lot of judgment towards it. I think part of it is the fact that a lot of the natural wine can taste a little kind of alternative. But I also think that's okay, you know. We're in a kind of world where everyone wants to know more about different kind of genres of food and different cuisines, and are up for having a different taste experience when it comes to dishes. But I think we rarely extend that same curiosity to wine. I think part of that is because, you know, wine ultimately is an investment. It is a fairly expensive product. But what I try and do as a sommelier through my writing and through my work in restaurants is break down some of those barriers and get people to trust me and get people to try things they might not have tried, and also be okay with experiencing new flavours, new textures. Natural Wine, No Drama is a kind of nod to kind of get over it. Natural wine is here to stay. It's how wine was always made, more or less, you know, until like the last century. And there's so much to be discovered.
And what do you look for in a great natural wine?
I think the thing about natural wine that really excites me is when I was kind of more classic sommelier, I was so used to this like formula to look for. And there would be like, you know, some fruit, some acid, maybe some tannin if it was a red wine. But I think what I love about natural wines is they have so many more facets to them, so many more elements. So you've got different ranges of acidities, you've got kind of different structures. If it's a skin contact wine, like we'll taste in a second, you've got this amazing aroma and this tannin at the same time. There's just so many more levels. There's much more of a range of experience to be had with natural wines.
The book is amazing because you've travelled a lot. You're really going to the root, as you say, of this kind of slightly academic side of farming meeting producers. And one of the things our readers and listeners love about wine is that ability to transport you, and, you know, that sense of minerality of the actual earth. You know, there is a sense of escapism in wine.
Mm.
And certainly in the book, it really is there. So I thought it would be great to get your take on that.
My life in restaurants is very immediate. What I loved about writing the book is there was some sort of level of, I can create something kind of permanent and revisit a lot of these memories and a lot of these bottles that I've been pouring over the years. Georgia has this incredible history. You know, it's almost certainly confirmed that it was the original place for making wine, and that style of wine would have been skin contact wine. I love tasting wines from this region because when they're made well and when they're made in a natural way, they are so just bursting with life, and they've got a structure. They use a little bit of skin contact, which brings out this like really amazing vivacious structure in the wine. There's just always something very special about drinking Georgian wines. Other countries like Slovenia, Slovakia, the north part of Italy, where enormous winemaking history as well, and history of making these kind of like heavier styles of orange wines that really, really, really speak of a place.
Orange wine is a whole
other... We're going to try one actually in a second.
Well, maybe we should try some because it's wonderful to hear about your travels and a sense of, you know, these incredibly dedicated makers. So you're in Georgia in some beautiful hillside somewhere. Amazing.
So this is made in a tiny, tiny region just underneath Russia called Lechkumi. This is actually an Australian guy who moved to Georgia and set up his life there, and I think that's just such a beautiful thing. The grape is called Solikuri. I think the interesting thing about Georgian varieties is that they're just not planted anywhere else on earth. You know, whereas, you know, you get Merlot and Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc that are found a home almost in every viticultural area in the world. Georgian varieties have never left Georgia, and I think there's something incredibly special about that. You are literally tasting a piece of earth from a particular time when you're drinking Georgian wine, and that experience can't be replicated. And the label here is beautiful as well. So the Georgians have had a long history of being invaded by every possible angle. In Georgian folklore, when a Georgian soldier falls, you know, a vine will go through his heart. So there's almost a sense of kind of renewal there. So here, I really get the sense of like lots of kind of freshly cut green apples. It's a very kind of evocative smell. Lots of apple, maybe leading into some kind of quince. And when you drink it, it tastes like a really fresh, vibrant white wine that you might be used to, you know, buying from a wine shop. But there is this real sense of kind of electricity coming from the wine that you really feel. It's very kind of palpable. It's almost like someone's just poured a little bit of seawater into the wine. It's got this kind of like salty minerality to it. I love, and I find really, really useful when pairing with food. We do a lot of seafood dishes here at Suna, and it works so, so well.
I think that's maybe why people find them quite wacky.
Let them, you know, more for us.
Maybe wacky in a good way.
Yeah. We're actually going to go all the way to Australia. I did actually feature this beautiful couple, Tim and Monique, in my book. They have a biodynamic farm just outside Adelaide in South Australia, and they inherited and have subsequently planted a whole host of varieties. This is a skin contact. I don't know if you can see it, but it's almost like a snow globe here. This is absolutely the definition of hashtag unfiltered.
Oh, wow.
It's almost, yeah, you've got this snow globe thing.
So what is that sediment?
It's just sediment. It's just leftover bits of grape from the winemaking process. Conventional winemakers would filter this out. But the idea of natural winemaking is that anything left in actually really bolsters the texture of the wine. And I really subscribe to this too. You know, I'm a sommelier, I work with food. There are wines that can be served as an aperitif, like maybe this one. Or there are wines that really are designed to work better with food. So yeah, this is made with a couple of varieties that are really internationally known. So Sauvignon Blanc is in here. Sauvignon Blanc is one of those varieties that it does generally tend to smell and taste the same no matter where you are in the world. So there's this kind of maybe herbal note, this kind of lime flavour. Gooseberry is a big one with Sauvignon Blanc. So
and it's this incredible colour, which is orange.
Very much
amber
orange.
Amber kind of.
If you get your nose really deep inside it as well, it's almost like a kind of graphite smell, like a kind of pencil shavings or pencil lead.
It's very poetic, isn't it, the life of a sommelier?
Yeah. And then on the palate, again, super salty, really mineral, a little bit of menthol character alongside all of those really beautiful, almost like tropical fruits.
Yeah.
And you feel the structure there as well. It's got some tannin like you would associate with a red wine, but then you've got all of this aroma that you would associate with a white wine. So it's just an amazing thing to be able to play with when you're matching natural wines particularly and food.
But I think it's interesting that you said tropical fruits, because there is that sense your brain kind of leaps with joy when you see this colour. But then you kind of have that tropical association, then you have to ground yourself and think through that kind of structure, as you were saying, like you would a red wine.
Yeah, for sure. I think with skin contact wine, if you can almost get your brain to park itself and just think of it like a new category of drink. Don't think of it like a wine, a red or a white or a rosé. Think of it like a new thing. And then people's kind of preconceptions fall away. And then you can experience it for all it is. There's so much more detail here than any white or red you've tried. There's different ranges of acidities. There's different fruit profiles that are often kind of contrasting. Like you've got almost some sour fruit in here along with some tropical fruits, which not very common, you know, in the world of traditional wines. It's usually one or the other. You've got this structure, you've got these beautiful aromatics jumping out of you, but then you've also got this amazing salty kind of menthol savory character. It's a load of things in one package, which you just wouldn't get with traditional styles of wine.
And in terms of history, I mean, you mentioned that some of these wines, this is how they were made for millennia. Orange wine, does it have an interesting lineage? Who was drinking this in the past?
Well, I mean, we'd keep going back to the Georgians, but the earliest kind of evidence of winemaking, I think in Iran about 8,000 years ago, but also kind of very soon after, evidence of winemaking in Georgia as well. And actually they found pips in the skins in a horse hide or something like that, which indicate very much orange wine was in vogue back then. But everything started to change around the time of the First and Second World Wars, where, you know, vast amounts of men were taking off to war and there was this massive kind of agricultural burden on everyone kind of left behind. And so this is exactly the time that fertilizer companies started becoming quite prominent, and all of these kind of companies that would turn up and say, you don't need to work as much in the vineyard or wherever you are and whatever kind of agriculture you're in charge of. You know, you can do less and get more yields, and, you know, you can then use this kind of herbicide to tone down the weeds in your vineyard or whatever. So this has kind of led us to this kind of like spiral of to where we are today. But also I think there's this kind of desire for cleanliness and for things to be fairly black and white or red and white in this sense. So I think a wine that is unfiltered and orange has probably been a little bit too extreme for the palates of a post-war world. But I think now, like I said, the world is, and foodies and people that are into new experiences, they are searching for these kind of more nuanced flavours and the stories behind that. And so I think that orange wine is finding its kind of natural way back into vogue.
Well, honey, thank you so much for talking us through these beautiful wines and for having us here at Suna.
Thank you.
Cheers. Brenda, does the idea of picking a natural wine for a dinner party inspire or daunt you?
It completely inspires me. I think if you're putting simple, natural ingredients into everything that you have prepared and cooked for a dinner party, why would you want to take the chance with anything other than a natural wine?
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay. Marcella, what about you? Are you a fan?
Yes. Oh, I love natural wines. So I should have joined your tasting. I know natural wines from pop-up restaurants in Zurich, as young chefs often have a selection and recommend natural wines. And I think they taste every time so different, and it's each time a unique sensorial experience. Sophie, your guest spoke about how one of the benefits of natural wine is that it limits the severity of a hangover. How did you feel after the tasting?
Well, I mean, we didn't drink very much, but it was interesting. When I was recently in Warsaw, I went to a natural wine bar and I really did drink quite a lot. And the next day I felt great. But I have had some false starts with the natural wine world in London, with some quite fizzy and headachy wines that I didn't love. Orange wine that was just not for me. Occasionally I felt that I haven't really got off to a very good start. And then it's sort of taken me back to my positioning of being quite an old world Chateau Neuf de Pape kind of girl. Yeah. So then I really have to push myself and take that sceptical expression of my face, especially when I'm in the company of lovely Honey Spencer, who's so lyrical and amazing about this subject. I think there is also the definition of natural wine is no sulfates, but I think so many producers are making biodynamic wines with the most amazing passion, using very, very little in terms of chemicals or fertilizers, and they're not classed as natural wines, but those are the wines I really love. So I think it's a little bit problematic when you start over categorizing things, but I also love Honey's operation and her book's great. So yeah, I'm definitely on the fence.
No, I'm inspired. I'm inspired.
A long-time darling of London's indie folk scene, 32-year-old singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Marika Hackman is a musician who has taken time to hone her craft. Nowhere is more apparent than in her recently released fourth album, Big Sigh, an 11-track balancing act of sonic tension and relief. Confex Paige Reynolds sat down with the musician to find out more about the record.
I left my body in your care.
I had quite a musical time of it as a kid, and I was like learning the piano from the age of 4, but I actually gave it up when I was older because I really struggled to read music. So my piano exams, when you had to do sight reading, it was just like, it was so bad. It would be like silent and I'd be just staring at the page, like breathing really intensely, and then just hit like the wrong chord. But it was actually, I think, when I was about 14, I'd always kind of written little things on the piano, but not like proper songs. And it was very cool to be like into music at that age. And a lot of what was floating around was very much person and guitar vibes. So I picked up a guitar and started to teach myself to play, basically, in my downtime. I was never learning the guitar to be a guitarist, ever. That was never on my horizon. I didn't give a shit about being able to take a big solo and shred and all that stuff. It was just so I could write music. So that was a really big turning point, because then I just started writing songs, and I would just go home from school, sit in my room and write songs. That was it. And then that was in my brain. I was like, okay, well, this is what I'm going to do. Even though I went to art college for a bit, I started gigging when I was 16. So I was like, that's just going to be it. And I was writing songs, you know, like when I was 16, 17, I think. The first single that I released when I was 20, maybe, was a song that I'd written when I was like 17, 16, in that room on that guitar, you know. So that was the beginning of it all, really. I definitely go into it being like, I need to write a record, and I'm gonna write a record. So it was always an album, which is, I guess, quite a scary way of actually looking at it. I've never thought about it in those terms before. Certainly the whole like blank page feeling. So the beginning bit is definitely the hardest. You just have to show up for it like every day, like any other job really. Like, I'm not gonna write a song if I'm not sitting with an instrument somewhere quiet. Like, I can't walk around town and be like, ah, I'm not Paul McCartney dreaming up yesterday, whatever it is, you know? So it's like I have to be there for it, which is frustrating if you have writer's block, because you spend a lot of time trying and nothing happening. Yeah, after I did have maybe like kind of three and a half, four-ish songs, you know, it was kind of like, ah, here we go. And then you start to see what it needs. Well, the record's kind of telling you what it needs. You know, like the last two songs I wrote for that album were Slime and The Yellow Mile. And it really needed those two songs. But like, you can't force yourself to write something in a certain way, but it's like you have this funny relationship with your record instinctively. Like, you just fill in those gaps. We've got grease on our feet and a bag of weather. It was a very long journey, and it was emotionally taxing and very tiring. But that being said, I think because of that, it's the most honest writing that I've done for a very long time, because I was purely focusing on writing songs and not thinking about what I was even going to be talking about in those songs or how it was going to sound or what identity I was going for on this record. It was just about, like, I've got to write these songs. I've got to write a collection of songs that fit together. So I was just focusing on whatever the hell was going on in the depths of my soul. The Ground is like such a intro-y kind of track, and then the first proper song is like No Caffeine, and it comes in and hits you on the record. So it was funny with actually all three singles, though. They're all very different. They really show the furthest corners of the record with No Caffeine, Slime and The Yellow Mile. They're like definitely pulling it, stretching it out. But yeah, No Caffeine, it's funny. I love that song. It's probably my least favourite on the record, which is really interesting because it's a lot of people's favourite on the record. I don't know whether it's because I had quite a wrestle to write that one, hence why actually I think the subject matter is what it is, because it's like, so it feels so sort of frustrated and like, oh, and like resigned, and it's like, and those are all the feelings that you have around like anxiety and panic and things like that. So there's a lot of different versions of that song, basically. There's like a slow jam version with like completely different lyrics, with like a, it's like it feels like walking through mud now, like listening to that compared to this like kind of relentless upbeat kind of assault that that song is now. The bit I love about that song is the brass parts with the did 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 did, because it's like so tongue-in-cheek, that like it's such a kind of like ridiculous like goofy part that I totally deliberately put in to basically just, it's kind of like me being like fuck you to my panic, just like you can't bog me down. The record is just, it's just opposites, the whole thing. It's like how everything in life, there's two sides to it and they have to balance each other. Everything is a balancing act. And so where I push things to their extreme, if you take, for instance, the beginning of The Ground and the end of The Ground, and like they're so dynamically different, and just even the instrumentation and stuff like that is just completely opposing, which is kind of setting the parameters for the rest of the record. With Hanging, it's like you have something that's so sort of stifling, so up close, the lyrics are so horrible, to then basically just give, like, it's like a huge fucking blast of like sunshine coming in. It's just, it had to have it, that you have to give opportunities to listeners to like actually breathe. There was a lot of sighing that went on during the process of making this record. The phrase big sigh, you know that that classic thing about how everyone, when they have dogs and their dog does a stretch, and everyone goes, oh, big stretch. My partner Polly, basically, whenever I was sighing, was being like, started saying big sigh. And then we started saying it, me and Sam started saying it in the studio, because we'd both be working and it's like, you know, there's moments of quiet where you're fiddling around on the computer or something, or you're just kind of like thinking, and one of us would do like a big sigh and then another one would say, oh, big sigh. It kind of became this little catchphrase, and it just summed it all up. Like, it is, the whole record is a record of different kinds of sighing, really. The pinnacle being the end of Hanging, where you have this huge, big, like, tumultuous release that just feels like a massive exhale after the, like, tightness and the suffocatingness of that song. And then you go into, like, The Lonely House, so it's just like a little piano instrumental, and it's like another moment to just kind of, like, let go, breathe, and kind of get pulled back up again by the next track. Like, it's just full of sighs.
That was the musician Marika Hackman. Her album Big Sigh is out by Chrysalis Records now. You're listening to Confect Corner. It's time now for our final thought. This month's writer, Julia Lesica, takes inspiration from her Ukrainian heritage and tells us how a pagan ritual has helped her forge a connection with her ancestors.
Spiraling white lines, stylized horses galloping across the night sky, bright yellow stars. As a child, I was fascinated by the mysterious symbols scrawled under the shells of Ukrainian busynki. Traditionally made in preparation for Easter and pagan spring festivals, busynki are eggs decorated with geometric designs and floral shapes using heated beeswax, a tool called a kistka, and dyes made from flowers and herbs. Their presence in Ukraine predates the coming of Christianity in 989, with fragments of ceramic busynki found at archaeological sites dating from the 5th to the 3rd century BC. According to folklore, busynki ward off evil, with the yellow of the egg yolk symbolising the return of the sun after a long winter. They are so key to Ukrainian culture that in Soviet times, Russian authorities would purposefully destroy them. My family and I left Ukraine and moved to London when I was 5. I grew up and went to university in the UK, yet Ukraine continued to draw me back. After returning from summers visiting relatives and friends we had left behind, I gathered material reminders of the country, pairing my vyshivanka, the embroidered national dress, with ordinary clothes and matching it with the red coral necklace my uncle had gifted me from his travels in the Carpathian Mountains. But the quiet craft of the busynka continued to elude me. It's a tradition that requires seclusion, contemplation and concentration, as well as special tools. I could hardly ever find time for it. The year that Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, I finally came round to experimenting with Bysinki. As tanks rolled through the forests of Ukraine's northern border and streams of camouflaged soldiers entered the southern and eastern cities, Lent began. In a show of resilience and determination to stick to their traditions, women across the country unwrapped their kistki and began to mix their dyes. Although my hands were shaking and I was far away, I lit a beeswax candle and dipped the first egg in colour. I wanted to draw. Some eggs cracked. On others, the dye bled, sullying the distinctions between shapes and patterns. But as I laid thin lines of wax on the shells, my arrangements grew more distinct. I read about the symbols. An octagonal star for love, flowers for fertility, a bird to represent the human soul. I found myself drawing roosters, the light that overcame darkness, and oak leaves for strength and patience. One evening, I stumbled across an online lecture on Kazimir Malevich. Known to most outside Ukraine as a Russian painter, the modernist great was actually born to Polish parents in Kyiv in the late 19th century. Baptized in the same church as me, Malevich's work was permeated by Ukrainian folk culture from his time living in villages around the country, something that Russian critics, aided by unknowing Western counterparts, omit from history. For most, the suprematist language he is known for is a curious arrangement of shapes and colours. But for Ukrainians, it is a remastered version of the ancient hieroglyph-like language of symbols practiced for centuries on clothing, whitewashed walls, and eggshells. Working late into the evenings up in my attic room, straining over these small white eggs, I finally felt connected. The word bysinka comes from the Ukrainian word to write or to inscribe. Tracing the symbols and marks of my ancestors, I was creating a prayer. On the delicate surface of the shell, I was producing my source of strength.
That was the writer Julia Lesica. Marcella, Pysanky is typical of Easter in Slavic cultures. What were some of the Easter traditions you had growing up?
Well, I know Julia's Pysanky very well and understand the word as well, but I was not familiar with its origins and its history. So we have my family, we have a box, a huge box full of such beautiful painted eggs from my grandparents. And on Easter, when I was a kid, we put a branch from the forest in a vase and bound the eggs with long, colorful ribbons on it. It reminds me so much of my grandparents from Prague and their winter garden with this Easter decoration. Oh. Yeah, and by the way, I have also mentioned them in the beginning, when you remember, talking about my trip to Bucharest and the museum. What about you, Brenda? It's so interesting to hear how tradition can help us connect with our heritage.
Well, we too had a tradition of decorating eggs when I was growing up in Canada. Eggs were traditionally white. They had a white shell. So it was quite easy to dip and dye, and we had the wax candles as well. I'm sure we might not have been as gifted as Julia Lasica's relatives, but we gave it a good old try. Even with my own children in London, when they were growing up here, I would seek out white eggs, and we would roll them in oil and then dip them to give them a marbled effect. But it was just a lovely thing to do on the Saturday before Easter Sunday. And there's nothing as pretty and significant and symbolizing Easter as a basket full of colored eggs. And you, Sophie, there's something very rewarding about tradition that involves your hands, embroidery, craft, etc.
Yes, there is. I mean, it's so tactile, and I think Julia expresses it so beautifully that you can evoke the memories of people that have passed through that kind of repetitive movement. I mean, my grandmother was a great seamstress. She was Australian. And actually, I have an aunt, Molly Grove, who was a great weaver in Australia in kind of mid-century. It's interesting to look at the pieces that she wove and really see the family, the skills and the inclinations and the colours. You can relate to the past so interestingly through craft in that way.
Growing up in Canada, as I did, it seemed that people were able to do more than one thing. They might watch TV, and yet they were crocheting or doing needlepoint or embroidery. It was this kind of dual craft and television.
But interesting that, I mean, we had a most beautiful piece in Confect a few issues ago, and it was a weaver, a basket weaver, talking about she felt she was communing with humanity's ancestry, kind of like thousands of years of history, because weaving baskets has been with us since the very beginning. She felt that this sense when she was doing it, which sounded actually quite eccentric and some would say kind of a little bit wacky. But then actually when you think about it,
it's true.
Really it is true.
It's true.
And then when you go around a museum like the British Museum, you can see that the craft, there are these threads. This is what connects us. And I think that's why it's so endlessly fascinating. But needlepoint, which is not something I frankly have time for at the moment, was what my grandmother really excelled at. So maybe there'll become a point where I might revive that.
It's interesting the way that many big brands are investing in craft, Louis Vuitton, Chanel, they all want the craft and the craft workers to continue with their trades, and thank goodness.
Because the stories are quite literally stitched into the clothing.
Yes.
And that's what the beauty really is about. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Confect Corner. My thanks to Brenda Tui for joining me here in London and to Marcella Palik in Zurich. Confect Corner is produced and edited by Carlotta Ribello and Christy O'Grady. We'll be back next month with more, but until then, from me, Sophie Grove, goodbye and thanks for listening.